As the medium is the message, if I'm talking about KISS, keep it simple, stupid, I thought this was the best way to go. I get very nervous when I see people fiddling around with the laptops and going back and forth and getting lost. So I thought that would be suitable. My name is Tzvi Bisk. I beg your pardon? My name is Tzvi Bisk. Does everybody hear me now? Okay. I apologize. I know I go up and down, and if you don't hear me, just throw something at me. Okay, good. I think we would all agree that the energy environment or the environment energy conundrum, and they're the same thing, is one of the major strategic problems facing human civilization in the 21st century. It may be the major one. And as I talk, I want you to keep in mind, as background music, just several things. Bridging strategy, that's what I'm going to be talking about. I'm not talking about finalist solutions here. Low-hanging fruit, something you've all heard of, and I think there's a lot more of that around than people think. The perfect is the enemy of the good. We all have heard that. And I say the good is also the enemy of the better. And in my life, I just try to make things better. So I'm going to be talking about the better, not the good, and certainly not the perfect. And the fourth thing I want you to keep in mind is the art of the politically possible. What can be done? Well, we have to talk about time. Time matters. Politics matter. Economic interests matter. What can be done immediately, within 1 year? I'll give you an example. I'm on the 14th floor of this marvelous hotel, and I'm looking out on a sea of roofs all painted black. Unbelievable. I'm looking out on streets, because asphalt is naturally black, that are black. Now, when Moses came down from Mount Sinai, the 11th commandment was, all streets shall be black. They can be white. And then you have something, I think it's what it's called, the Aldebo effect, that reflects. And one of the statistics I read, and I'll get to statistics in a moment, because statistics are very confusing, as Mark Twain pointed out. But this is one statistic that made sense to me, that if you paint the roof white, you save 6% of the energy for air conditioning. And since air conditioning is something like 40% of the electricity consumed for residential and consumer, that's pretty simple. You know, there's high tech, there's low tech, there's no tech, and there's hello. I looked at streets, no trees. I looked at parking lots. I don't think it would be too difficult to mandate that every sixth parking space has a tree. I think I would prefer to park under that tree. If there were no birds on it, I mean, it's a different story. So immediately 1 year, then what I call the short term, what can be done in 5 years, and the intermediate term, what can be done in 10 years, that's what I'm going to be concentrating on in the talk. And there's something I call the intermediate long-term 20 years, long-term 30 years, and deep long-term science fiction, which I love, and, you know, space elevators and solar space, great stuff. I believe in it. I think it'll happen, but probably not in my lifetime. And by the way, I have to apologize right at the beginning. I have now officially reached the age where I'm legally permitted to be a grumpy old man. So if I'm sarcastic, please forgive me. KISS, keep it simple, stupid. There's the famous story, which many of you may be familiar with, of how the Soviet Union and the United States addressed the problem of writing in weightlessness. Big problem. Well, the Americans did it in a very typical high-tech American way, and they got a lot of R&D and a lot of real smart guys from MIT and Stanford, and they invented a ballpoint pen that can write in weightlessness. It cost something like $20-25 million. A very expensive ballpoint pen. The Soviets, being a little more primitive, went to their neighborhood stationery store and bought a gross of number two pencils. Okay, that's... What are the confusion of statistics? And these, some of the discrepancies I'll talk about in a bit. You know, you read, automobiles are responsible for 18% of greenhouse gases, deforestation for 18%. Somehow they always get to 18 to 20%. I don't know where they get this stuff from. It's okay. Domestic animals, 18 to 20%. Agriculture is 20%, by the way. More than cars, which is interesting. And then you have scientific sources. Oh, I got it. Oh, I'm not that primitive. I have a pointer. Oh, okay, this is some of the scientific sources. If I was writing an academic paper, I would give you the references. Okay, now how can something contribute between 36 and 72%? I have no idea. I have no idea what that means. 95% makes more sense to me. Water vapor. The total greenhouse gases. Because the things I just named, cars, deforestation, landfill, that's the human contribution to greenhouse gases. It appears that human beings contribute maybe 5 to 6%. It's called anthropogenic. It's a very fancy word for man-made, of greenhouse gases. And over 90% are from nature. The evaporation of water, methane from bogs, etc., etc., etc. Carbon dioxide, which contributes 9 to 26%. Methane, 4 to 9%. Ozone, which I thought was good, I didn't know it was bad, 3 to 7%. I'm being a bit sarcastic because I believe that these statistics confuse people. They drop out of the issue. They say, leave me alone, I don't know what they're talking about. And I'm talking about even intelligent people who are concerned with the issue and have been to university. I know when I hear these talking heads talk these things, I go, what? For example, look at this one. This is the kind of graph you find in many high school textbooks now and in popular articles. Now, what does that mean? It means that this doesn't work. Oh, here it goes. Okay. By sector. So this is man-made. Okay. Do they mean the percentage of the tonnage or the percentage of the effect? They don't tell you. I'm going to assume the effect because that makes more sense. But they don't tell you. Okay. I beg your pardon?
I'm sorry, it says emissions. I would imagine that's...
Yeah, but emission... But you read, sometimes you read emissions, we emit 2 trillion tons or pounds of CO2. They'll do it in a volume. They don't say emissions as percentage of the greenhouse gases. Different sources use different standards. If anybody here can point me to a source that is precise about this, I would very much welcome it. I'm just telling you that if you're going to make policy, and this is policy, in other words, you're dealing with reality which is inhabited by human beings, which we all know about human beings, they get confused. So I don't know what this means, but I'm going to assume it means the effect and not the absolute volume. Okay. Now, there are other statistics which to me make more sense. Let's say that CO2 is only responsible for 50% of greenhouse gases, of man-made greenhouse gases, and not the 72% in the previous graph. And these are sometimes called the ignored greenhouse gases. Now, as we know, methane is 25 times more, or 20 to 25 times more, depending on the source. Sometimes it'll say 20 times more. Sometimes they'll say 25 times more, no definitive. Nitrous oxide, hydrochlorocarbons, and soot. Okay. Now, some scientists and environmentalists say it would be cheaper, and if cheaper, probably politically easier, to phase out these 50% of greenhouse gases than to tackle CO2. CO2 is the whole cap and trade thing, which we'll get to in a moment, which has many problems politically. Okay? And the reason is they claim that methane remains in the atmosphere for 8 years, soot for only a few weeks, and CO2 for over 100 years. Which is something I also don't, I have to admit to you, I don't understand what that means, because I thought that CO2 was a vital part of photosynthesis, so it remains in the atmosphere forever, but maybe they're talking about the surplus CO2. They never specify. They never specify. So I'm going to ask some simple questions understood by all, the answers of which are, I believe, indisputable and self-evident. And since I'm speaking in the United States, I'm addressing the United States as the model. If I was speaking in Europe, I would use them as a model. If I was speaking in Israel, I would use them as a model. Every country has to have its own strategy. Question one. Does dependence on oil compromise national security, financing both sides of the war on terror? Yes or no? I say self-evidently yes. Does dependence on oil compromise America's economic security? 70% of America's trade deficit is petroleum. Oh, by the way, imports of petroleum are not taxed. All domestic energy production is taxed. And an importation of ethanol from Brazil is taxed at the rate of 50 cents a gallon. Don't ask me what the logic of that is. I have no idea. Okay. Do the real costs of OPEC oil, which include policing the Persian Gulf, lost tax revenues, etc., make the present actual cost of a barrel of oil $400 a barrel? So what they've done is they've externalized many costs. People talk about, oh, we can't subsidize alternative energy. Boy, are you subsidizing oil. It's just hidden. It's hidden in the defense budget. It's hidden in the fact that you're not collecting taxes. It's hidden in the fact that if it's being imported, you're not creating jobs at home, etc., etc., etc. Does air pollution caused by burning fossil fuels damage personal health and property and thus the economy and the taxpaying citizen? Yes or no? Anybody says no to any one of those questions, I walk away. and don't waste my time because I've now become officially a grumpy old man and I don't want to argue with them. Even an anti-global warming uber-conservative thinks that the proper function of government is to protect the person and property of the individual, provide for the common defense, and guarantee social order at a minimum expense to the taxpayer. I can't imagine any sane human being, wherever they are in the political spectrum, denying that that is a fundamental basis of what government should do. So I say a KISS energy environment policy has the possibility of enlisting 100% of the citizenry. It bypasses the entire global warming debate. Don't get me wrong, I think there is global warming. I'm not on the other side of the debate. Yet its implementation, but it bypasses the debate. It doesn't get into that. It doesn't get into these, you know, these trivial details. Yet its implementation would greatly alleviate the human contribution to climate change, which I believe is a better phrase than global warming, because as we know, global warming can cause in certain areas global cooling, and then all the demagogues on television, talk radio, whatever, can go crazy with this, and the average guy says, oh, it's all a bunch of crap, and I'm not going to deal with it. So what will not work? Self-righteousness and moral indignation will not work. I was once chastised for being for alternative energy for the wrong reasons. Okay. Like, I'm a security nut. I had to be for it to save the planet, which I think is a ridiculous statement to begin with. The planet's going to do okay. We have to save ourselves. That's you know, if the planet survived the Permian extinction, it'll survive us. Will we survive us? We're kind of like bacteria in a petri dish. You know, we're getting to a point where we're going to kill ourselves. That's the problem. Nuclear. Now, I'm not against nuclear ideologically. I think there's a lot of demagoguery about being anti-nuclear. There's more radioactivity in the environment from coal dust, from coal ash, than there is from nuclear plants. You know, coal is radioactive. If you're living near a coal generator, you're getting more radioactivity than if you're living next to a nuclear electrical generator. But it does not address the problem of transportation. We have a multiplicity of sources to generate electricity. Oil has a total monopoly on transportation. A total monopoly. A colleague of mine by the name of Gal Luft has just written a book, Turning Oil into Salt. When salt had a monopoly on the preservation of food, you know there were wars fought over it? And then somebody invented canning, and then somebody invented refrigeration, and now salt, they throw it at you for free. You know, in biblical days, you could buy a human being with salt. The very word salary comes because the Roman soldiers were paid in salt. Sailors, sailing, comes. That's the first commodity. Salt was more vital than oil is today. You couldn't live without it. Now, salt. We eat too much salt, all of us. Okay? But there's something even more important. There is a worldwide shortage, and in America, a catastrophic shortage of master welders. Simple thing. What is a master welder? A master welder has 10 years' experience and perfect every time weld. Now, I'm for nuclear energy, but I got to tell you, if it's in my backyard, I don't want the welding to be done by a retrained computer programmer. Very simple. A worldwide shortage of mining engineers and civil engineers. There are cultural changes that are affecting the workforce. How many young people who go to university today want to study mining engineering? It's not sexy. You go to a party and you say, what are you doing? Well, I'm going to be coal mining. Ew. Not going to get very many dates doing that. Civil engineers. Well, the problem with that, in the United States especially, but also around the world, is if you haven't been maintaining your infrastructure for the last 20 or 30 years, which you haven't, well, then civil engineers don't have jobs, and they're not studying, because civil engineers are almost totally dependent on public expenditures. And you can't import them from India and China, because they're expanding their infrastructure like crazy, and they have a shortage of civil engineers. Okay? So, welders, mining engineers, civil engineers, when people, let's go nuclear, I go, okay, puff. Maybe, maybe not. I'm probably going to say something that's going to offend somebody. I can't help it. Drill, baby, drill. I call that the mantra for morons. The problem is not peak oil. The problem is peak exports and peak availability of oil. The major 14 major exporting countries are all increasing their own domestic use of oil at double-digit numbers, except for Norway. All the others are. They're buying cars. They're upgrading their added value by doing their own refining and not exporting crude. They've realized that if you make plastic out of it and fertilizer, you're going to get more money. They're not stupid. The 450 major oil fields in the world are now declining at a rate of between 5 and 10% a year in their productivity. You know how an oil field is developed. It takes about 5 to 10 years. Alaska will take like 10 years to get the first barrel. Then it'll take another 10 years to get to the optimal 800,000 million barrels a day. It stays there for a couple of years, then it slowly declines. Every single major oil field in the world is now in decline. Indonesia has now been forced to leave OPEC. Indonesia is now a net oil importer. Mexico may become a net oil importer within the next 10 years. Of course, their fields are plummeting. So new discoveries, as well as resource-to-reserve technologies, and here I want to tell people confuse what resource and reserve. You'll see these articles once in a while on the internet. America has 10 times the oil of Saudi Arabia because they count the oil shale and all this other stuff. That's a resource. That's not a reserve. A reserve is something that can be technologically and economically exploited. And one of the reasons why 40 or 50 years ago America had 40 billion barrels of reserves and today it has 40 billion barrels of reserves is technology has moved many of these resources to reserves. What's the problem? Energy return on energy invested, EROI. That's the second. The first one is return on investment. What does that mean? Well, when Colonel Drake, he wasn't a colonel, drilled the first oil well in Erie, Pennsylvania, it took the equivalent of one barrel of energy to get 100 barrels of oil, and today it takes equivalent of one barrel of energy to get 10 barrels of oil, and in some cases, one barrel of energy to get 3 barrels of oil. Imagine the energy you have to use to build these tremendously sophisticated offshore rigs, which we now know are not that sophisticated, but whole different issue. A huge amount of aggregate energy to build them, to maintain them, to drill miles between under the sea and then miles under the seafloor to transport this oil. This is all energy being used. Also, the development time is longer, 10 to 15 years, before you get your first barrel. And But there's another question, and this is the same thing as with nuclear. It appears that 50% of the global oil workforce will retire within the next 10 years. The average age of people working in petroleum today is over 50. There is already a 38% shortage of workers in oil. Once again, the cultural component. People don't want to do it. It's hard, it's dirty, it's dangerous, and it's not fashionable. It used to be fashionable. It's not anymore. We often ignore these psychological components of policy. Cap and trade. Now, don't get me wrong, I am for this ideologically. I think if you're going to use the commons as a toilet, it should be a pay toilet. However, I think it's a stupid strategy. And it resembles the following quote coming from World War I regarding the ill-fated British landing at Gallipoli in World War I, when the German Admiral de Roebuck said, "Gallant fellows, those soldiers, they always go for the thickest place in the fence." And I think energy environmental policy that stresses cap and trade is going for the thickest policy in the fence. And why? Well, I'm looking at the United States. I have identified at least 23 coal and oil producing states and or states dependent on heavy industry. The labor unions associated with these sectors, the major corporations. The fact that we're talking in the American system about 46 senators from both parties, all of whom have log rolling agreements with other senators. Log rolling, in case you don't know, is you do this for me, I'll do this for you. Right? That's what politics is about. It's also open to corruption. Because it's complicated. And I believe a rule of thumb is the more complicated the policy, the more complicated the procedure, the more complicated the regulatory system, the more liable to corruption. And I'll give you some examples. Europe has cap and trade. The following was reported in the New York Times on March 18, 2010. Trading in carbon dioxide credits came to a halt on two European exchanges, one of them owned by the New York Stock Exchange, the other owned by NASDAQ, because of double selling of carbon permits by several countries. They had a little tax fall. Well, we'll do a little of this. Okay? Last year, 2009, swindlers robbed governments of almost $7 billion by selling carbon credits and then disappearing before paying the required value-added tax on the transactions. In January 2010, swindlers used faked email messages to obtain access codes for individual accounts on national registries that make up the bloc's emission trading system. And then they used the stolen codes to gain access to electronic certificates that they then sold. Guess what the regulatory regime is going to look like in the United States? When I read this, I didn't know whether to laugh or to cry. Okay. In the Senate climate bill, the job would go to the Commodities Future Trading Commission. They're the only ones that could handle derivatives, you see, carbon derivatives. Now, we all know how good the regulatory agencies are doing this. In the House climate bill, The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission would assume the main responsibilities. We can already see interscene sovereignties fighting out one another, and what's, you know, I think the Bernie Madoffs and the Ken Lays of the future are out there just slobbering, waiting for this stuff to go, oh man, could we make a lot of money out of this? The real killer, this is really, in the House bill, after lobbying from the chairman of the House Committee on Agriculture, wanted to hand the authority for farm offsets to the Department of Agriculture. What was the agency, the MMI, the Mineral Management? MMS, what is it?
Service.
Managing the rig. I put it to you that this would be something similar. This would be the cat guarding the milk. Cap and trade will probably pass. But I think it will consume a huge amount of political capital with little environmental return. And that's why I wrote this new acronym up there, EROPE. You know, your environmental return on political energy invested. What can be done?
And then I apologize for the low quality of this, but I'll try to. And you notice I'm concentrating on oil, because I think that's the politically easiest thing to attack, not coal.
Okay, so what do we see? Commercial and residential consume 6% of the oil. Now, America consumes something like 20 million barrels of oil a day. That is equivalent to 1 to 1.2 million barrels a day. In other words, 300,000 to 400,000 barrels a day more than you would get from ANWR in 20 years if you started drilling tomorrow. Okay? So my first thing would say, okay, let's retrofit America and not use oil for commercial or residential purposes. Who would be your allies? The entire home improvement and hardware industries. Home Depot, Lowe's, Sears, sectors of Walmart, hundreds of small and medium-sized chains, all their suppliers. Much of what they sell is domestically produced, by the way. All the workers in these sectors, millions of people. The construction industry. Professional labor. It's politically doable. It's attractive. And you can do it within 5 years. You can paint the streets white and the roofs white tomorrow. And you can do this within 5 years and save 1.2 million barrels a day. Then there are the KISS standard, the standards of California. Let me put it this way. If the entire United States had adopted the energy policies of the state of California, America would be consuming 40 to 45% less electricity than it does today. I'm going to repeat that. 40 to 45% less electricity. And how did California do it? By painting roofs white, by making sure that ventilation systems were clean. Nothing high tech. All low tech or no tech. This would reduce America's global warming pollution by 25% without raising electrical bills. Now, 40 to 45% less electricity is approximately today the same amount of electricity produced by coal. California has flatlined electricity consumption for the past 30 years. In other words, their electrical consumption productivity has gone up 3 to 4% a year, as opposed to 1 to 2% a year for the rest of the country. By the way, I prefer the term energy productivity over energy conservation, psychologically. When you say energy conservation, people imagine, oh, I got to turn down my thermostat, I have to turn off my air conditioner. Productivity, that's a dynamic, it shows you're progressive, etc. But I think it's also more accurate. It's psychologically more amenable to the common person, and it's also more accurate. Okay, so we can eliminate 1 to 1.2 million barrels a day just by retrofitting buildings. Industry consumes 4.6 to 5 million barrels a day for product. This can be covered by the liquefaction of the coal you have saved in electricity. Now, the objections to the liquefaction of coal up until today have been because the liquefaction, by the way, this is a process that's existed for 50, 60, 70 years. Nazi Germany used it. South Africa used it. It's from the 20s and 30s. What it does is it produces a lot of CO2, but today we have, within the next 2, 3, maybe at the least 4 years, technologies that will be able to convert CO2 into oil. So this can be carbon neutral, and you will get maybe 4 million barrels a day of oil that can be used for product. What do I mean? Plastics, fertilizers, pharmaceuticals. I happen to believe that 100, 150 years from now, people will look back at us and say that there was a mass psychosis, that we burnt one of the most valuable natural resources that we have to move stuff. It's like, well, why not burn, you know, Louis Couture's furniture to move stuff? Oil is valuable stuff. Almost everything we, you know, my glasses are plastic. This, it's plastic. Let's use coal. Who would be the allies? The entire coal industry. Companies and unions. It's 1/3 of the Senate, as well as heavy industries and their unions, that would be used to produce these coal-to-liquid facilities. Another ally would be patriotism. Strong ally. It's local. Patriotism is a strong ally. Let's not ignore it. Natural gas. Synthetic gas. Natural and synthetic gas. Synthetic, I'm talking about gas from garbage, manure, sewage, food waste, etc. I've read some sources that claim that the manure produced by the feedstocks in America alone could produce the equivalent of all America's present natural gas production. In other words, you can start a process where you're dependent on natural gas and by 2030 have transitioned that natural gas to synthetic gas. And the reason I'm saying that because I know now we're discovering that there are some environmental problems in getting natural gas. Using gas to replace diesel for fleets, taxis, buses, trucks, trains, government vehicles. Now, trucking industry alone in the United States consumes 20% of all the transportation fuel. That's 2.7 million barrels a day. Add on the others, and you probably get to 4 million barrels a day. This could be saved by converting these fleets to gas. The environmental benefits, I believe, would be enormous. This is a policy already being begun with the Kerry-Lieberman bill, being supported by someone like T. Boone Pickens and his, what he calls the Pickens Army or whatever it is. This is something already underway, so it's not something that I'm inventing. And the allies are the transportation industry itself, operators and Teamsters. Because this policy would negate price volatility of fuel. The biggest enemy of the transportation industry is volatility in pricing. If a barrel of oil is $150 and then drops to $35 and then goes up to $80, airlines, trucking industry, they don't know how to price deep into the future. They buy futures, they gamble, they lose the gamble. Stability is the name of the game. Allies, once again, would be patriotism. All electricity in the United States, after retrofitting and after the KISS California policy, could be provided solely from various forms of solar, wind, existing nuclear, as well as increased use of cogeneration and something which is now coming into fashion. It's got a very ugly name. It's called parasitic energy harvesting. Has anybody heard that term? Parasitic energy harvesting. Now, there's a company in Israel called Innowatt that has taken something called piezo crystals. Now, piezo crystals are those, is a material that when you traumatize it, produces electricity. That's how you light your gas stoves. When you push it down, it goes tick, 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 tick. That's a piezo crystal. Okay. They're now placing it under highways. Okay. The Italian Autostrada system has now ordered a whole bunch of their stuff just to become energy independent for their lighting and everything else. In other words, they're using it for highways, for high-density pedestrian areas, for heavy industry, which has violent machinery pounding. In other words, this is wasted energy. I mean, I'm walking. If I'm stepping on it, I am creating electricity. I'm not using up any more energy than I would by walking on it or driving on it. What is the efficiency? Four lanes of a kilometer can produce 400 to 500 kilowatts. 2 miles would be a megawatt. In Israel, we can produce 250 megawatts. That's a quarter of a major coal producing, because that's 1,000 megawatts. But you take something like New Jersey, the New Jersey Turnpike, or the Garden State Highway, or both of them, I think you're talking about thousands of megawatts that could produce that way. Ambient energy, using mini wind turbines in subways, in tunnels. Truck goes through, a car goes through, it produces, it moves the air. One of the benefits of this kind of energy, as opposed to big centralized Thomas Edison type energy producers, is you get the energy incrementally. When you build a major generating facility, until you have everything, you have nothing. Until it's finished, you have nothing, and you've tied up billions and billions of dollars. Private transportation. How much time do I have? I want to have time for questions. Okay. Private transportation consumes, in America, something like 8 million barrels a day. If you mandated E15 or M15, E15 is ethanol 15%, methanol 15%, combination with gasoline, You would not have to change any infrastructure. The present infrastructure could handle that. You would save between one, you would save about 1.2 million barrels a day within 2 to 3 years. Once again, I'm going to refer to ANWR, drill baby drill, 20 years until you get 800,000 barrels a day. If you ended all taxes on imported ethanol, you could do that. Now, you might have some objections from the farm, from the corn lobby. However, corn is now being used to replace petroleum in many industrial applications. Something called polylactide, PLA, is made from corn. It's a biodegradable polymer, and it's used today in clothing, packaging, carpeting, recreational equipment, food utensils. So you may be able to have the same kind of social contract with the corn producers as you would have with the coal industry, which instead of using coal to produce energy, would be using coal to produce product in a much more environmentally friendly way. And then, of course, you can mandate flex fuel engines, which Brazil has done, I think, 10 years ago. Every engine sold in Brazil is flex fuel, and it can use any combination of ethanol, methanol, and gasoline that you can think of. And this, by the way, only adds $100 to $150 to the cost of an engine. It's not a big deal. The technology is there. So by 2020, the combination of E15 and E85, M85, that's a combination of ethanol 85, methanol 85, could together replace 4 million barrels a day. So let's add it up. 1.2 million for residential, 4.6 million for coal, 4 million for gas, and 4 million for flex fuel. That is equals almost 14 million barrels a day. If domestic production, along with Canadian and hopefully still Mexican imports, can be sustained at between 6 and 8 million barrels a day, which is what it is today, with various new extraction techniques, the United States could become energy independent by 2020. Energy independent, not self-sustaining. That's a different story. Independent means you can tell any one of your suppliers to go away, like salt. Now, with dramatic decreases in the weight of vehicles, because I think the future of the energy environment conundrum lies in the revolution in material sciences. Carbon nanotubes, composites, bucky paper. And here the analogy in cost is to the cell phone. You know, our cell phones today have more computing power than NASA had when it put Neil Armstrong on the moon. I'm not even talking about our laptops. That cost them tens of billions of dollars. Today they give it to us for free. What am I talking about? Bucky paper, or carbon nanotubes formed in a paper, in 1990 cost something like $30,000 a gram. Today it costs $90,000 a ton. The analogy in history is to aluminum. In 1852, aluminum costs $1,200 a kilo. Aluminum was more expensive than platinum, gold, and silver. Aluminum was the rarest metal in the world. Then somebody discovered a new way to make it, and in 1859 it cost $40 a kilo. And by World War I it cost 40 cents a kilo. And today it costs $3 a kilo. Same thing can happen with carbon nanotubes. In other words, let's consider what energy you would have to expend to move a jumbo jet that, instead of weighing 400 or 500 tons, weighed 40 or 50 tons. So you know your college physics, you know it's not just one-tenth, it's much less, because the more the mass, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not talking about science fiction here. This stuff is already happening. This is stuff that between 2020 and 2030, I think will become commoditized. Then you have the potential of the electric car. Now, there's a lot of objections about the electric car that are just totally nonsense. And then I'm going to end this talk and let you attack me. Okay. Well, you need to produce energy to charge the battery. So what are you doing? What are you saving here? Right? That's the objection? Okay. An electric engine is 85% efficient. It only weighs 15% of the energy you put into it. A petrol car, I'm living with a woman who's British, so I say petrol. Otherwise, she wouldn't understand what I'm talking. When I say gas, she says, you don't feel well. You know. A petrol car is between 15 and 20% efficient. And diesel is 25, 30% efficient. It has to do with the number of moving parts. If you've been to New York City and some of these real old buildings where they still have some old guy operating the elevator, they have electric motors that are over 100 years old, still working. So that's number one. Number two, how do you deliver electricity? By electrons. And how do you deliver petrol and diesel? By molecules. Well, delivering molecules is more expensive than delivering electrons. Even with the old Edison way of producing it, you're losing 30%, 40%, whatever. But when you deliver petrol to a gas station, you've got to put it in a truck, somebody has to drive it, the truck is energy, the tires, you're burning gas, the people who work at the gas station have to come there and work, they're consuming energy, etc., etc. But there's other benefits to the electric car. It's the most efficient way to store intermittent renewables. Israel will be the first country in the world to have electric cars. The second will be Denmark. Why Denmark? And the initiative here was by the Danish electrical company. 25% of the electricity comes from wind. Even in Denmark, when was most of the wind blowing? At night. What are they doing with it? Nothing. It's just going into the wind. But if you have electric cars, you can charge the batteries at night when most people are sleeping. There's another benefit, what they call car-to-grid supplementation. You know that the entire electrical system of any developed country is built for about 100 hours out of the year. You know that. I mean, for example, New Jersey, its peak is in August. They need 18,000 megawatts between 4 and 7 o'clock in the afternoon in New Jersey. So the whole thing is built for that. In January, they only need 10,000 megawatts. Okay. So let's say, and now you can do it with very simple existing or modification of existing programming. Because the electric cars are all going to be programmed. You know, it's going to tell you when you need to recharge, when you have to change the battery. In Israel, it's going to be a battery change. It's going to take 3 minutes, less than it does to fill up your gas tank. You're going to go into something that's like a car wash. It's going to take the battery out, put the battery in, 2-3 minutes, you're out. You know, because it takes 6 hours to charge the battery. And in the meantime, in Israel, the battery will be charged by solar. In Denmark, primarily by wind. But if you have differential billing, for example, you're paying less for electricity at night. You can charge your car at night in your garage or at your home. And then if you're at work and you get contacted or you have some kind of contract with the electrical company and your car is plugged in, and they say, can we take 50% of your battery at this time at a higher rate? And you're working, you don't need it. Say, fine. My battery's full, take 50%. I can get home on the other 50%. Most of the driving that you do is less than 20, 30 miles a day, even in the United States. Right? So it has a multiplicity of benefits. There is no shortage of lithium. There is no shortage of rare earth materials. And even if there were, right now, there is a huge driver for creating new kinds of batteries. You had the lead battery for 50, 60 years because it wasn't a big market. Now, believe me, there are dozens of initiatives. There's a guy at the Technion that's developing, I don't even know the physics of it, a silicon oxide battery. Now, silicon's made out of sand. We have a lot of that in the Middle East. You know, no problem. Okay? So you're going to have all kinds of right now, the batteries. Batteries will be there. Okay. Now, one last thing. What are you going to save in terms of pollution if you go electric? If in the United States tomorrow, by magic, every car was electric, and 100% of your electricity was coal, which it's not, you would still have a 60% reduction in CO2 because of the 85% efficiency and the delivery, which I mentioned. Now, America will probably be the last adopter of the electric car for very economic reasons. In Israel and in Europe, it costs us 20 to 30 cents a mile to travel. In America, it costs you 8 or 9 cents a mile to travel. The electric car is going to cost you 12 cents a mile to travel. So until you have expensive energy, which you probably won't because it's written in the Constitution that you should have cheap energy somewhere. I haven't found it, but I've been assured that it's there. That you'll probably be last adopters. But all your garbage, all your sewage, all your organic waste can be turned into gas, and that can be your primary mover of vehicles. Okay, questions? Yes. Could somebody give me a glass of water, please? Yes.
If every car on North American roads got the same fuel efficiency as the Prius, you'd have to import no oil into North America and not have any offshore drilling. So rather than focus on fuel supply, if we focus on fuel productivity, we could solve that problem quite quickly.
Well, that was the whole thesis of my talk. I just didn't mention the hybrid because I have a national interest in selling the electric car. So that's. But yes, who is the? What is the guy at Nissan Renault? Goshen, what's his name? He's against the hybrid. He said it's like a mermaid. When you want a woman, it's a fish. When you want a fish, it's a woman. You know. He's French, you know. You have to. That's the French humor. That's. Yes.
Caveat about corn ethanol. It takes very nearly as much energy to make it as you get out of it.
Absolutely. So, I didn't want to mention that.
I would advise strongly against corn ethanol. I think that was a boondoggle promoted by the corn farmers.
It's stupid, but they have a lot of political power. So I agree with you. It's like one-to-one. One unit of energy to produce one unit of energy or something like that.
Well, it's not quite that bad. It's like 0.9 units to produce one unit.
Okay. Well. I lose, you win.
Another.
I agree. Yeah.
Another notion about the storage of energy is the question of using flywheels. Is your electric car going to be able to climb a hill?
Yes. Well, first of all, it will, but about flywheels, this is like one of the oldest technologies we have, but now combined with new materials, lighter materials, they are looking at flywheels, yeah. Because
I relate to an experience that I recently met a fellow with a startup flywheel company in which they have patented technology for having the flywheel itself act as an electric motor when it's running up and an electric generator as it's running down. And this thing was a DOD contract to have a flywheel on a Hummer, which would power a laser weapon, which was has actually been tested to be able to destroy a tank and shoot down that four.
It's interesting. The Defense Department has developed something in Iraq, a depolymerization unit, which you have a unit in the field, and it takes all their human waste, their garbage, their trash, and turns it into synthetic diesel. Because they say that's cheaper to do than trucking in diesel and have these guys get killed and this sort of thing. Now, it might cost $1,000 a barrel now to do it, but it's still cheaper for the Army to do it. But I predict that these mini depolymerization units for anything organic will become commercialized within 10 or 20 years. I see no reason why any restaurant shouldn't be off the grid, all the garbage they produce. I see no reason why any hotel shouldn't be off the grid. My point being is sometimes the Department of Defense, such as like the interstate highway system, the internet, they come up with stuff that they're thinking very narrowly, but has tremendous implications for civilization. It's very interesting.
Well, I would argue against them being off the grid if they're producing more than they're using.
Oh, they get on the grid, right. Absolutely.
And adding to the grid.
I agree.
Now, in California, we have a little incentive for people to have solar.
Can you all hear this, gentlemen? Yeah, okay.
They have an incentive in California to have people to install solar energy on their homes. My debate partner from high school did this, and he thinks he's going to get payback in 7 years. But the thing that they fall short on there is they won't buy it back from you. If you produce more than they'll set you up with a meter. So that when you're using,
you're off them.
You're off.
Yeah.
You're using your own. But if you
than
you use, they won't buy it back.
In Israel, they're forced to buy it back. Yeah. We have the same policy.
Actually, they will buy it back starting next year. They already passed the feed-in tariff. Now, my question is whether the DEC is trying to establish a viable avoided rate. But they already passed the law to force PGE to buy it back.
Oh, okay.
We're just waiting. In fact, people are already upsizing their photovoltaic arrays in anticipation of it, because anything you develop between now and the end of the year will be credited after they decide the amount.
Okay, so the general thesis, I'll just sum up, is it's really easier than we think, and there are a lot of people out there who make a business out of making it more complicated than it is. And I think we can just look. Yes, please.
I don't know. I think the most complicated part of this is behavioral change.
Absolutely.
So there's been a number of articles. In fact, I think neuroscience may end up having part of the solution to this, why it's so hard for people to change.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so if you're talking about this on a mass, which turns out to be the biggest problem we have, I guess one of the questions is, given all the data and everything else, what are the strategies that actually begin with both behavioral change of younger people, especially because I think actually they have a chance to actually.
Well, they're the ones that will be the first adapters. I mean, yeah, absolutely. No, I agree. I mean, we tend to argue rationally. But there's something out there called reality, which is really nasty because it's occupied by human beings, and sometimes they're a problem. Yes, please.
talking about would require a change or action by the government versus how much of this could just happen by the private sector on its own?
Well, retrofitting could be totally by the private sector. Look, you have to have some kind of government framework to make it really work. The liquid gas, the LNG for trucking is through the government. They're getting a lot of, they're enlisting a lot of pressure on them from the trucking industry to do it, But there's stuff we can do on our own. America is a very interesting country because it's a federal system. You've got 50 states, and each state can be a laboratory. And within the states, in many states, the various local authorities have a lot of autonomy, so they can do stuff. And, I think you've got 30 or 40,000 different municipalities in this country. I mean, so there's a lot of stuff that can be done here without a, if it's in France, it's got to be central. If it's in Israel, it's got to be central. But America has all this political flexibility, which in some ways is inefficient, but in some ways makes it a very dynamic society. Somebody raise their hand here? Yes.
Kind of plays off that idea as well as some of the other discussion, and it has to do with your notion of energy productivity, what most people call energy efficiency. It would seem that there's a lot of economic incentives for energy efficiency. Why don't we get there?
I got to tell you something. In my youth, I was a socialist. And I worked for the Israeli Labor Party for 20, 30 years, and it doesn't work. So I became a capitalist. I'm a free market guy. Well, one of the reasons I'm a free market guy is it's a system that works despite the utter stupidity and incompetence of so many business people. I have a small business. Translation business. That's how I don't make my living. Futurism, my God. I have a translation business. And we run into businesses that are successful. And I'm constantly amazed at the stupidity, the incompetence, the laziness, the cowardness of so many business people and managers. I don't have an answer for that. But that goes to what this gentleman was talking about, neuroscience. You go to them and say, if you do this, you're going to save $10 million. I just think you just have to keep chipping away. And one of the great inventions of capitalism is called bankruptcy. And there's a kind of a Darwinian thing going on. The people that do it will survive. The people that don't do it. My father was a small businessman. He said, I love recessions. I said, you love recessions? Yeah, he says, all the inefficient businessmen go out of business. And the people who know what they're doing manage to hold on, and then they're the ones that when the economy picks back up again. I thought he was crazy. But, when you're young, you always think your father's crazy, but that's a whole different story. But it turns out I think he's right. It's a process. Thank you very much. Oh, yes, please. Yeah.
When do you see that we can move towards a larger quantity of electric cars? Because right now I see a gap between the capability to charge the cars or provide the electricity for the cars. Just last week, New Jersey had a blackout. They strained the grid, air conditioning 103 to 106 degrees, right? Okay, we're going to plug in 100,000 cars.
Not it.
We're going to produce the cars quicker than we can effectively charge these cars.
Even New Jersey, when it had the blackout, at 2 or 3 a.m., it was only using 40 or 50% of its electrical production. It had the blackout at 4 to 6 in the afternoon. You're not going to charge your car. You won't be able to charge your car. If you plug it in, it won't charge. There'll have to be some kind of, what it will do is make electrical production more efficient, not stop and go. Because now what they do at night, they stop some production. Well, that costs energy to stop it, too. It's like stop-and-go driving. Then in the morning, they jack it up again. Well, that also is wasting energy. If they can level it out, that will even make the electrical production more efficient, and the electrical car can enable them to do that. But the problem is the personal consumer. It's not... People will solve the technical problem. If there's money to be made and a consumer to buy something, the system will find the solution. And there's money to be made, and more consumers are going to be buying this stuff. Thank you very much.